are listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hello, Sammy.
Hi, everyone else. My name is Aiden. My pronouns are they, them. I'm the pastor here, and I have to choose how much I get this purple light shined in my eyes. Oh, thank you. If you haven't been here before, the same rules apply to talk time as all the other time, that you can get up whenever you want and get snacks whenever you want and go to the bathroom whenever you want and dramatically storm off whenever you want, but that last one might be a bit distracting. So if you're going to storm off, just do it quietly. Last week was a long weekend, so we did a contemplative psalm service, but at the moment we're doing a series on, you know, that's actually not any better, Andy, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, my God. Yeah, good. We're doing a series at the moment in Matthew called Jesus' Contradictory Sayings, because I don't like boring sermon series, so there has to be a theme that's not just Matthew, in which we pick two things that Jesus says and that seem contradictory and be like, what's going on? In this case, Jesus has picked his own contradictory sayings, so we only have one series, one passage to go through, and that is Matthew 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount, which is the, you have heard it said, I say to you, blah, blah, blah. But before we look at the specific passages, we'll just do a recap of our principles of interpretation. Yes, I did spend a long time at university. Which should be the next slide. Oh, there we go. So we think about who is being spoken to and who is listening, with the understanding that Jesus wasn't writing a memo specifically to New City Church on the 2nd of May, 2025. Really? Oh no. My watch is wrong. What genre is Jesus using? Whether he's using parable, wisdom literature. We looked last 2 weeks ago at that proverb. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. Wait. So that's just an example of sometimes things that are contradictory can be doing that on purpose as part of a genre. And finally, that it's fair to assume that Jesus does understand irony, satire, metaphor, rhetorical questions, double entendre, sarcasm, and sass, but that doesn't mean that it will be expressed culturally in the way that we expect. Any questions on that? Great. What's next? I face the back because I don't have Sammy's theater training. Okay. The other thing that we've been doing at the end, especially if you remember our last series, is that one of the questions I'd often end in is, what do we as readers bring to the conversation? And usually I just say, I'm the reader this week. Here's what I'm bringing to this conversation. But over this series, I'm going to encourage us to bring in, you could think of our life intertextuality as we're going in. So these are your heads up. At the end of the sermon, I'm going to ask you if there's something you have to bring in. So for me, it's a good sign if you feel like this feels related, but I'm not sure how, and some kind of story that's happening in your life or some kind of theme or question. And then we can kind of work out together if there's some extra knowledge to be gained from what you're bringing in. Obviously, you don't all have to think of one, but I am going to be asking you that at the end. So that's your heads up. Next slide. Here is my question for today. Is there such a thing as objective morality? I'm going to give you 2 minutes to discuss amongst yourselves. Go. Okay, everyone. I've had my second snickerdoodle, so it's time to get back to the sermon. Who has a strong opinion on this question? Oh, Sammy, tell me, is there an objective morality?
No, there is not an objective morality.
What?
Let's talk about it.
Why not?
I believe that we're going to have to move a little bit further. Now I'm in the middle.
I live my life here.
I believe that in terms of the morality and living your life in the most moral way is not causing pain or harm to others, because everyone's lived experience creates different triggers for that harm and that pain. It creates an infinite amount of moral situations that could hurt or not hurt other people. So everyone's morality and what triggers pain or not comes from different places. So it's individual to each person.
Is God good?
Yes.
Does God change?
Yes.
Ooh, so that's how you put it together. Nice. Does anyone have a different opinion? I'll go Chris.
I went yes, because I said there are some things that are definitely always wrong. And so the example I gave was killing or raping children. Right? Like, I just think there's no way that you can justify or excuse those things. Yeah.
Sure. I don't have a response to that. Yep, sounds reasonable. Andy?
I think, yes, there is. I agree with everything Sammy said, but I just think that means that morality is contextual, and that doesn't mean it's not objective. Yeah.
Ooh. Any other thoughts? That sums up everyone's opinions. Wow. Okay. Oh, Pete.
But if we say there is an objective morality, then there must be some agreed, maybe not a source, but who is to say what that objective morality, that agreed objective morality is. And therefore, yeah, I'm not sure you could actually find that or identify it. And it has a question of source where that comes from. Even if you might have one thing like the killing or rape of a child, I don't think that proves the point that there is objective morality on the whole.
So you're saying, like, really the question is there such a thing as accessible objective morality? It's a good point. It's my job to interpret you, because that's actually all your ideas, the good ones. Anything else?
Lisa.
Keep it going, babe.
Just keep it going. Well, you know, brought up Einstein's theory of relativity. Everything is relative to, so I kind of thought subjective morality to, because morality is how you respond to certain agreed laws and context. So your sense of morality isn't necessarily the law, it's your sense of what's right and wrong. And so in the case of killing someone, it's relative to what the situation is, it's subject to what the situation is.
So you're saying, like, if morality is actions under specific circumstances, it necessarily changes based on the specific circumstance. Does anyone think of morality as something other than actions?
I don't know if this always applies, but I do think, like, intent can have a big role to play. Like, yes, if you don't mean to hurt someone, but you hurt someone, that can also be very bad. But I think also there's, like killing. You can be killing someone with the intent of protecting other people. Maybe that makes it a bit more gray, but then maybe it's like the intent part has an impact, but at the same time, I don't think you can just go like, I didn't mean to do it. Yeah.
Do you think there's objectively good and bad intent?
I think causing harm because you want to cause harm is objectively bad.
Yep, fair enough. Okay, now that we've warmed ourselves up, I believe we're reading the passage next. Oh, that's so tiny. Does anyone want to read Matthew 5 from their Bibles, or shall I read it from the slides? Or does someone have really good eyes? Oh, Leona. Matthew 5, starting from verse 17.
Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Oh, sure. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Oh. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, rather, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell.
Okay. The things I've colored on the slides are either things that I want to emphasize or things that I have translated differently. And I will explain them to you. How many of you are looking at the passage on your phones right now? Just, do you guys all have, you have heard it was said, but I say to you? Yeah? Interestingly, the preposition in Greek is ambiguous as to whether it is an agreeing or disagreeing preposition. In English, we only have and or but, really, but other languages leave it up to you to decide whether the second clause is agreeing or disagreeing with the first clause. So I've put then there, which I've seen other scholars do before, just to try and create a bit of that ambiguity. But that means that we have to decide whether it's an and or a but or something ambiguous on purpose. Isn't that weird? So scholars divided it by other people into three camps about what they think Jesus is doing here. Each of these passages Jesus is quoting either a law from the Torah, the Hebrew scriptures, or some rabbinic wisdom surrounding a law from the Torah, and then presenting something else. Some people say that it's agreement. You've heard it said, do not murder. And I say, actually, lots of things are technically murder. Some people say it's disagreement. You've heard it said, do not murder. But I say, well, that's obviously, I'm teaching something else here. And some will say, well, maybe it's a little ambiguous. So just keep in your mind what you think maybe that preposition means and carry that through the different sayings that Jesus does, and maybe it might be clearer over time whether we think Jesus is agreeing, disagreeing, something else with the teachings that he's relating to. Stay on that slide. I've also translated the quote here, which I'll read out for you. Everyone who is angry with his mate, brother or sister is like kind of a fraternal fellow disciple, and so I thought this closest Australian equivalent was your mate. Anyone who's angry with his mate would be guilty by local council. And then the various crimes that the person does, the important thing is that they get lesser, but the consequences get more severe. So it starts with being like angry, and then it starts being like, well, you're good for nothing, like a pretty serious insult, and then it becomes like a pretty mild insult. But the consequences go from like effectively local council judgment to like the Pope condemning you all the way to Ben Hinnom. Who was here for our Gehenna Hell series? What, like two of you? Come on, who was here for the Hell series? Okay, thank you. Here's one of our Gehenna references. Who remembers what Gehenna was? Andy?
They did child sacrifices there, right? And then I don't remember who, but someone came along and cleansed the whole place by fire and made it so that they couldn't do sacrifices there ever again.
Great. What else? Anyone remember anything else?
It was outside the city gates, so it was kind of like a no-person land.
So it was a literal valley around the edge of Jerusalem that had several historical fires related to it. I'm doing a recap for those of you who weren't there. It started as being a place where child sacrifice was practiced, considered very bad universally. Then became a place where the Josiah's cleansing fires, where he like basically destroyed historical fires. And then when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem, they heaped up the corpses of the people in that valley. And so prophets at the time of the Babylonian conquering said, the reason why, like, there's so much death happening in this valley, and then when the consequences of those times that there was fire that spread to innocent victims is now being revisited back on the people who perpetrated those crimes. So it becomes this very sort of reflective moment of violence, really commonly used, not just like when you do bad things, you get punished, but very much a sort of when, like, the fires that you perpetrate return onto you, the idea that violence begets violence. Who's been preached to on this passage before? Does anyone, how has this been interpreted? Does anyone want to share an interpretation? Oh, yeah. Right, so just like more things that you absolutely 100% can't do and it should be really obvious, stop it. I was taught, interestingly, that what Jesus is doing in this one and elsewhere is saying, you think it's really easy not to murder, but actually it's so much harder. It's actually impossible. That's why we all need grace. Did anyone get like something along those lines? Okay, we'll keep that in mind too, because we're going to assume that because Jesus is doing several of these, that perhaps like interpretations of some passages can be weighed up against whether they're also worthy interpretations of other passages. Okay, next one. Who wants to read?
Next one. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your mate had something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny.
Does this shed any light on interpretations of the previous paragraph for anyone? Oh, do you want to tell me?
The thing that I was going to share about the last passage is that I think it's easy to have a takeaway of, like, don't get angry. Yeah, like, actually to sort of start to associate guilty feelings with anger, which is really emotionally unhelpful.
Yeah, but this passage is assuming that you, like, you know, you actually will get into fights with your mates, and so this is what you should do if that happens. No, like, sorry, straight to Gehenna, but like rather just can just have a conversation with them about it, maybe. Okay, let's do the next one. There's six of these like kind of sayings of Jesus, but we will probably only do the first three.
You've heard that it was said, "You shall not commit sexual misconduct." Then I tell you that anyone who stares at a woman lustfully has already committed sexual misconduct against her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into Gehenna.
Thanks. I also forgot to say in our Hell series, I'm looking at you, but many people weren't there. We looked at how there's many different words that are translated as hell, and probably the only one that really has the emphasis of like moral consequence is the one related to Gehenna, and that's what Jesus is using in this one. Okay. Does anyone have any questions about the translation decisions I've made in this passage? I did choose sexual misconduct rather than adultery. So, here's the rabbit hole I went on this week. First of all, we don't know what adultery means. We just have the context in which it is used. Like most words in the Bible, no one sat down and made the authoritative dictionary of words. And so people have had to infer from context what exactly words refer to. And that's probably why in contemporary society we're not even sure what adultery means in English, because, like, when do we even use that outside of the context of the Bible anyway? Just take it for now, and I'm going to explain it in the next passage. Actually, no, I'll tell you now. There are two words in Greek that Chris probably knows, traditionally translated as sexual misconduct or sexual immorality or adultery. Do you know them? Porneia. Do you know the one that's normally adultery? It's okay, it starts with M as well. Anyway, no one knows Greek, so it's fine. Porneia is the, like, more general term for, usually translated sexual immorality. I think that's actually a very good translation because it seems to refer to a whole host of taboo or harmful sexual practices that don't necessarily involve sex, that don't necessarily involve more than one person. It's often a reference to, like, sex without consent or sex as part of religious rituals, stuff like that. Any kind of... This happens every week now. So then the question is, if that's kind of the kind of catch-all for, like, sexual immorality, then what's this word that I've translated sexual misconduct? Now, scholars have previously looked at all the different occasions when these two words have gone and gone, no, every time there's, like, sexual misconduct, this adultery word, that's because it's actually at the breaking, not just sexual, like, bad things, but marriage-breaking bad things. Because the vast majority of the references are used for cheating on your spouse or having more than one spouse or divorcing one spouse to marry another spouse. So they've translated that adultery and used that to infer to things that break the marriage covenant, because that does seem to describe most of the uses. However, we don't... There's no one married in this passage. Like, if you assumed that everyone was married, you could assume that perhaps the man was married and the woman that he was staring at was also married, but to somebody else. But that's a long way to go to assume that the problem here is breaking of marriage covenant and not just, like, kind of sexually bad things to do. I think, I've only done a moderate amount of research on this, I'm not, like, a specific scholar, that the common theme for this particular phrase is whether there's victims involved. That there's some forms of sexual activity that are harmful but not necessarily have obvious victims. And then there's sexual misconduct that is against other people, whether against your spouses or against the people that you're Googling at. So that's why I've translated it this way. Any questions? Does that make sense?
Would that be a possible explanation that fits with that view, given that it's gendered? Because a lot of the references to this sort of thing in the Old Testament were about, you know, this theory is that it was about protection of women. Would that, your theory, explain why it's sort of like anyone but who stares at a woman lustfully and emphasizing woman rather than anyone?
Yes, that is one of the going theories. The two big theories are just that, generally, when you speak in teaching discourse in ancient Israel, you assume that the listeners are men and that they're heterosexual. But the other one is that Jesus is specifically looking at, like, patriarchally, like, upheld forms of sexual violence. So it's definitely, like, that's definitely a common opinion. Okay. What about the cutting up off of the hands and eyes? Who feels yikes? Who feels, no, I understand what this means. Ho-ho, let me hear it. Oh, but you know what it means?
I think he's saying it's better for you to suffer physical pain and lose an essential part of your body than to lose your whole soul, because if you commit sexual misconduct against somebody, then you've done grave wrong in God's eyes.
Thank you. Any other thoughts?
I was just thinking, do you think it might be hyperbole? So it's whatever it takes to do the right thing. If it's inconvenient or it's hard, do it. And then the cutting off is symbolic of taking the issue seriously, and therefore changing your life forever after that. Because you know, the hyperbole, if your hand's gone, it's gone forever. So it's going to be an inconvenience, it's going to be a disability, or whatever. So it's going to impact the way that you live.
Yeah, and I've heard those like things that you think are absolutely essential to yourself but might not actually be essential to yourself. Yep.
It sounds to me like it's also about advice about how to prevent yourself from committing these immoral acts. It's like how someone who has a problem with alcohol abuse would remove things from their life that cause them to be exposed to a situation where they might engage in drinking. So you're preventing yourself from having the opportunity to do immoral acts.
Can I like devil's advocate you a bit on that? Then surely there's more obvious things to cut off if that was the intent.
Well, what I would say to that is stuff can be two things, right? I mean, I don't disagree that this passage is emphasizing the importance of removing that temptation from your life. But and that's why it uses like hyperbolic and very emphatic language. But also, if it was about like the consequence of those actions, then it may as well be like, oh, if your right eye causes you to stumble, cut off your arm. Like there's a very clear link to what's the thing that's exposing you to that temptation.
As someone who has heard a little bit of the like, don't wear short shorts lest you tempt others, I think this is very like, you're the problem, like the one who is lusting is the problem, and the solution is focusing on yourself, not removing the woman who you might think is, like, you might look at lustfully, but like the impact and the its personal responsibility.
I'm seeing this all kind of coming back to our thoughts. If you think a certain thing, there your heart will follow. And so it's more about, metaphorically in my mind, of course, but I like, even Paul seems to interpret this as dying to self, so, you know, so that you can focus on the spiritual.
And I think that's like, that's why Jesus says you've already committed sexual misconduct in your heart, right? He doesn't say in your eye or in your hand, right? Like there's clear understanding that there's intent, question mark, involved. Yeah.
We covered this verse in our Bible study a little while ago, and it got me thinking about it because it's really interesting, but I kind of saw the use of like the terms of the body part as more of a metaphor to like the sin itself. And it was a call to, I guess, separate yourself from the sin so it doesn't consume your entire being and to recognize it. So it's, I guess, stopping yourself from entering almost like a shame spiral, right? So if you say, I am this part of me completely, then it stops you from, I guess, having that relationship with God and prevent. So in order to save yourself, you kind of have to separate yourself from that as well.
Yeah, no, I really like that idea that like this is not, and that's really common in a lot of types of therapy, said this is not all that you are, that there's parts of you that aren't this. And I think especially if like we consider like really ingrained, like if this is a reference to like really ingrained kind of patriarchal attitudes, I can imagine like the idea that no, like you, for example, your masculinity is something beyond this, and this is just like a part of how you're expressing it socially at the moment, for example. Yeah.
You just got me thinking before about words and meanings and different things, and it just occurred to me that I feel like I'm assuming what lustfully means in the original Greek. Is there any debate about that, or is that pretty settled?
It's pretty sexy, but, I mean, like, sex is used metaphorically throughout the Bible as well, right? So there's definitely, like, when I was one of the things I was thinking about is like, when I think about hands and eyes, I think about kind of my life under global consumerism and things that I think are like inherently part of what I need to be a person, and things that would feel very hard to live without, but perhaps that it's possible, better for me to be able to live at peace without those things than to have continued the cycle of violence and have them, to keep them and have them returned on me. Yeah.
Are you implying that, like, the sexual misconduct could be anything other than, like, sexual misconduct, like consumerism, as you said just then?
I don't think that that's what Jesus was directly addressing, but I think about that's what it led me to reflect on. I'm not saying that Jesus secretly talking about capitalism, not here anyway. I covered everything. Do you feel like, let's talk about the prepositions again. Would you put an and here or a but here or something ambiguous? Okay, hands up for and. Like, and additionally, yes. Thank you for standing up for your opinion, Carl. I appreciate that. Who would put but? Yeah? Who would put, like, something deliberately ambiguous between and but? Yeah, great. Most of you, undecided. And that's okay. We welcome ambiguity here. Oh, yeah. Yeah, however, is also, I've seen that before. The other thing that I wanted to add is that hands and eyes can often have really powerful metaphors in the Hebrew scriptures. Like, if we think of, it looked good in her eyes, so she did it. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Eyes is often represented with desire and judgment of what is good and evil. And hands often represented with power. Like, as in literally the word for power is the same word as the word for hand. So some people have looked at this and interpreted eyes and hands as specific references to intent and desire and power and action. That's another thing that's open. We're going to the next one unless somebody stops me. Great. Oh, yep, Seth.
Side quest on the hands and eyes. So at work, I do a lot of stuff with body donors. And when we work with students and body donors, the thing that they find the most human are the hands and the eyes. Wow. Yeah.
That's... That's the thing that made it hard about working with. I love that. That's a great, what do we as readers bring to the conversation, everyone? All right, next one. Who's, oh, is that the last one? No, here we are. Who's going to read about divorce? Yeah, Leona.
It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. Then I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of sexual misconduct. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits sexual misconduct.
Who has spent far, far, far too much time trying to study this verse and what it means? Me! Well, yes. Okay. I'll just say it. Not a systematic theology of divorce, right? Any more than the last thing was a systematic theology of lust, or the thing before was a systematic theology of speaking angrily to people, right? Like, it wouldn't make sense that, especially if we think that, like, both the last two stories seem to have rhetorical exaggeration for impact or effect, right? It would be weird that Jesus is like, here's like an illustration to make you understand the vibes, and here's an illustration to make you understand the vibes. And no, this is just kind of a black and white situation. I don't know what to tell you. Second piece of evidence for that, not the only, like, position of divorce that the Bible takes. Like, the same words of Jesus are translated slightly differently in Luke, in which they say, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. And so has the marries another woman but doesn't have the commits sexual misconduct. So it's not, you can't, sorry, no systematic theology of divorce here. The other thing to consider is that so far in context we've been looking at, I want to say, kind of like forms of violence against people. Like, we've been looking, like Jesus says, we've heard of physical violence that's murder, but there's a kind of violence that's the dehumanizing of other people through your words. We've heard of sexual violence, but there's a kind of sexual violence you can commit without even doing anything. So there's really strong themes to suggest that, like, you know, in first century context, marriage was what kept women economically safe and socially safe as well. And so there's like that power dynamic that's really strongly in here as well, which is another reason that it might be using gendered language. Any questions or thoughts?
It seems to me what he's doing is he's deconstructing the law and he's making it relational. And when you deconstruct the law and he makes it relational, he tells you later on in Matthew that only two commandments, you know, are to love God, love others as self. And that's relational. Entirely relational. So every one of these scenarios is relational. Your relationship with your mate before you go to court, relationship with the stranger who you're actually already creating thoughts toward. That's a relationship you're creating in your head.
Any other thoughts on this passage? Or we'll go to, I mean, Lisa's already started us on common themes. Yes.
How do you resolve in the context of how important financial security for a woman marriage was at the time, the section about anyone who marries a divorced woman committing sexual misconduct?
Any thoughts from the crowd? I don't know. We have very few examples of that, what that context looked like in terms of remarriage. I bet, like, later in the passage, Jesus goes on about oaths for ages, and I have no idea what context he's talking about, but clearly it's important. And so I really think that I'm missing something here in understanding exactly what remarriage is. The studies that I have done on this point to the story of David abandoning his first wife, Michal, and then her father marries her off to another man, and then David comes and collects her, and then her husband follows her weeping, begging for his wife back, as an example of perhaps there's some kind of like messiness, or I'm not sure. I don't know. It's my honest answer. Wish we had a New Testament scholar about marriage right now. Okay, next slide. What are some common themes from these passages? But I'll ask you some more specific questions. Having looked at these first three, and you had to pick one preposition for Jesus' preposition, what would you pick? So, like, I'm agreeing with this, but I'm also like pointing out the implications.
Yeah, I feel like and but are just very aggressively one specific way. So implies a logical line from the first statement to the second statement that makes you think about the second statement in context of what the first statement says. So, like, you can say the second statement, but without the context of the first statement, you don't understand the direction that it's trying to go in.
Any other thoughts?
The ones I'm lacking, I'm cheating because I'm looking at the interlinear, which has all the different options. And the ones I'm lacking at the moment is probably however as a first, and then the second one I like here is moreover, which is a very rare one, which I'm like, ooh, I like moreover.
One of the best arguments against using but I've heard is Jesus doesn't say, you've heard it said, do not murder, but I say, go ahead and murder. So
I feel like all of these is like, so then is the one I like, because I feel like all of these are examples of Jesus going, this is the simple version of this. Therefore, this second thing I'm saying is an evolution of the first thing. So then it's like this, then this.
Love that.
I like therefore. You just said therefore when you were explaining that, and I was like, that's pretty good.
Nice. Okay. What are the common themes then of these three? But I say to you, then I say to you, however I say to you. Does anyone think that there are common themes? Yeah, Andy.
Applying the principles of the law instead of just the specifics of what it covers.
Yep, so definitely, and this is not just like Jesus is doing it because he's Jesus. Really common rabbinical tradition is to be like, the law says this, and then people have extrapolated it to mean this, but I think you should extrapolate it to mean this.
I think what we were talking about before about like actions, I feel like the first part is like the action of like committing this or committing murder, but like Jesus is kind of also extending it towards like heart posture and like intentions, which is what we were kind of talking about at the start.
I think it's not the extreme, like, endpoint isn't the only bad thing. Like, murder, a lot of the things are like, this is the most extreme, kind of a more extreme thing, but it's just because you haven't done the extreme thing, you're doing something along the way. That can also be that.
Do you think Jesus is suggesting that the thing along the way is as extreme?
I'm not sure.
As important, not necessarily as extreme.
Yes. Yeah, Kristen.
I think as human beings, we have a tendency, and I'm using the royal we there, to look for blame when we get into sticky situations, and having a clear-cut set of rules makes it really easy to externalize the locus of control and blame somebody else for the circumstances that you may have found yourself in, rather than looking intently at your own motivations and how they got you in that situation in the first place, which is what I think he's trying to get people to do.
I think that God intended for us to live in relation with each other well, and he gave the laws to Moses as a very basic starting point because he knew our tendencies to be not so nice to each other. This is Jesus coming to fulfill that law and saying this was God's original intention to have us live in good relation with each other. So he's calling us to a higher standard, because that was God's intent for us.
Really common theme throughout, even the Old Testament as well, that constant being like, no, it wasn't meant to be, but I'm technically correct. Like, the whole point is to continue on that journey.
I think what Jesus is like speaking about is like he's maybe addressing complacency as well, like speaking to people who are like, oh, well, like I haven't murdered or I haven't like committed adultery, so therefore I'm a good person and I don't need to do anything. I think he's like, no, like, you know, even if you haven't done these big things, like, there's still ways for you to improve and grow as a person. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
It's almost like the, such a bad thought. It's almost like there's the specific use of the preposition and the two statements next to each other. It's, as you said, not specifically saying one thing or another, but the point of the passage is to inspire criticism of your own beliefs of what you've been told. So you've heard it said, then this. You've heard it said, therefore this. Think about it. What do you come to? You've heard it said, I say this. What do you say? Kind of that, I would have thought about it for a lot longer and it would have been a more succinct phrase, but that's kind of the way I feel about it.
He's consistently talking about things that the Pharisees were pretty shit at.
Yeah, I'll take that. Okay, let me see what I wrote down. Can I have the next slide, please? I think one common theme is the value of human life. And this idea of like, it's not just about like technically, like, you know, I didn't kill anyone and I didn't like, you know, but like kind of thinking more about like what it means to give like your mate good honor, what it means for the people who are dependent on you. That's what I think about when I think about what would be like the extension of the divorce conversation in our context. We assume that marriage and divorce is exactly the same now as it was then because we've translated it using the same words, but I think about maybe it's a more relevant teaching for people who are economically dependent on you for safety and survival. Like, what does that mean? What does that apply if I expand in that kind of context? It's also interesting, I think, that Jesus framed these as specific responses to contemporary laws rather than claims to objective morality. Like, God, you know, if God came down to earth, like, God could just be like, hang on, here's my objective morality list. But instead, Jesus engages in this, like, dialogue with the current laws. I think, like Rachel really pointed out, that wisdom that, like, you know, you have to bring people along slowly on a journey to get all of that nuance in. I was trying to think about how I'd summarize it, and I thought maybe like, what do we owe one another might be a good one. I never finished The Good Place. I only watched the first two seasons, but okay. Let's take it to what do we as readers bring to the conversation? As you remember at the beginning, does anyone have any kind of stories in their life or any kind of things that they're thinking about that are kind of giving that, this feels related but I'm not sure why, kind of vibe? Yes.
I think this is related and I'm not sure why. The woman at the well. She had five husbands, but I don't think it was her fault. I think she was exploited. And I think that divorce teaching might have something to do with it.
Anyone see any connection between Woman at the Well and this that they could draw out?
Well, I think just on that point, that section of the passage, there's no sin that's called out for women who remarry after being divorced. Like, the passage very clearly places the agency with men in that situation, which implies that in that social context, a woman wouldn't have even really had the power to choose to marry five people. So that would have been something that she would have had no control over.
Women didn't really have the right to divorce in that context, not in Hebrew culture, yeah.
But Jesus does tell her to leave her life of sin, which suggests something that she has control over.
Maybe there's a difference between things that are your fault and things you have control over. Any other things people want to bring in that feel related and not sure why?
I'm not sure if I'm mixing this up, but there were, I think, was it the woman, there were the two women in John, the one at the well and the one caught in adultery. And from memory, I think Jesus only tells one of them to sin no more and not the other. I think... Yeah, and I was just wondering if that's telling, like, why that wasn't there in one of them. I can have a quick look. But...
I'm a little cautious against using, like, stories about times Jesus interacted with people to create, like, systems. Yeah. Here's my question. If, as Lisa said... Jesus could have just said, you've heard it said blah, 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 but I say, love your God and love your neighbor as yourself. Why didn't Jesus just say that? Guess what does it mean? Do you feel like, who's?
That scenario of the overarching principle can give people the opportunity to wriggle out of it. So here's an example. Use that as a basis, but I'm going to take it right to the extreme.
You guys are all such good theologians.
That's also just distilling the passage into one general principle, which is what we try to do in church, but not what Jesus was doing for the sermon. Like, it was for the people that he was talking to. So he would have been speaking using examples that were contemporary at the time.
So are you saying it was, like, not a simple answer because he was using contemporary examples? Or...
I don't think that's the only reason, but what else? Well, now I have to think about it and I have the mic. Okay.
What other reasons might Jesus have had to use rhetoric, ambiguity, stories? Yeah.
So I was kind of zoned out when Andrew was talking, so I don't know if that's what he said. But Jesus was constantly, like, people were constantly threatening Jesus' life, so maybe he was just trying to avoid saying something concrete that would get him arrested.
Using rhetoric and stories and being non-specific forces the listener to do the theology themselves, and that will hold more weight as a part of your ongoing morality than someone telling you what to do.
Yes.
So we don't find, like, loopholes and draw a line of, like, oh yeah, this is exactly good and God said this is bad. Like, we don't have that line if it's, oh no, in general this is a bad thing. So that's why the ambiguity's there.
What's the value of that ambiguity?
So we don't draw that line.
What's the value of not drawing the line? Lisa's going to answer that question.
I think I was thinking along the same lines as your line, which is there's a huge difference between the law and one's personal morality and applying themselves to that. So you can keep the law but sin in between the lines. And so the intent is to get away with something that advantages you over someone else, so it comes back to that balance.
Yes. All right, last one, Adrian.
Perhaps this relates to the speck in the log. The obvious, blatant murder is the log, but what you do in your heart is the speck. So you were saying, you know, you're looking at the attitude, but kind of flipping it around the other way. So I don't know, maybe it's related.
Making the laws ambiguous means that you can't use them to identify that they aren't about you. Yeah.
I can't help but think about the sort of power relations about him speaking and what these people may have been used to hearing in terms of people who got up to speak with authority. And it feels like he's kind of trying to flip that sort of use of power and saying, you know, I think people would have typically sort of gone to listen to someone like him hoping to come away feeling like they were right and somebody else was wrong, and that there were clear divisions between these things. And I think what he's doing is he's turning that narrative on its head and saying, actually, we're all wrong, because at some time or other we've done any number of these things. And so what does the law mean? Anyway, that's just a little throw in.
Yes. Okay. You all have already said this, but I'm going to say it back to you because I agree. I believe in a God who wants us to learn love and compassion for one another by giving it a crack and trying to work it out, and sometimes messing up and giving it another go. I'm less sold on the idea of a God who's going to give me a bunch of rules that I can just not obey and then it's fine, or a bunch of rules that are impossible to obey and then I get to give up and just receive grace, no more questions asked. I really love the parent who teaches their child autonomy and responsibility because they want them to share in that vision. Because of this, I don't think that Jesus is
expanding these laws so that we feel just as terrified as yelling at each other as of murdering each other. I do think that God knows that we are questioners and that we are debaters and that we are people who disagree with each other, even in good faith, even when we're both trying. And I think God thinks that's actually a good quality about humanity. If God had just said, as you've pointed out, just love your neighbor, we would immediately be like, well, who's my neighbor? Maybe if God had said, just do not murder, we'd be like, well, like, what counts as murder, though? Like, is war murder? Maybe if God had said, just don't commit, like, sexual immorality, we'd be like, yeah, but, like, what counts as sex, though? When the question should be, what counts as harmful, right? And so by almost giving us a little bit, I want to say it was like a safer playing field for theology, so that we're not sitting around being like, well, what counts as murder, discuss, but rather if we assume that some forms of verbal violence are as serious as murder, let's discuss, right? I can see that being given as a gift for us to work out with each other, because I think that is an ambiguous answer and that we're going to come to different answers, and that the activity of trying to come to those answers will teach us love and compassion for one another. So I think that when I ask myself the question, why didn't Jesus just say it simpler, I think that's what I'm resting on, is that in giving us sort of complexity, Jesus is not just teaching us that, like, there's teaching us two things, I suppose, that there's all kinds of things that can be harmful, that could be not treating one another the way that we should. And here, over here, is where we're going to have the conversation and work it out together. Not over here in the light, but like, don't murder people, but kind of in like, what does it mean to speak to one another kindly? What does it mean to think about one another respectfully? What does it mean to have obligations to those who are dependent on you? And so I think that's part of the reason why Jesus brings in this ambiguity. And that's why I like the then for Jesus, because I think some people will say, that's exactly what the Torah is doing, and Jesus is just bringing it out. And some people would say, well, that's not what the Torah was doing, because the Torah is law and he's doing something else. And so it's almost like that then holds the fact that for some people that is a natural expansion of what they've already been taught, and for other people it's something very different as well. That's what I think. And so I'm not going to... A traditional sermon would try and move into application areas for these, but I'm not going to. Because what I want to instead is give you, like, the opportunity to say, these are working out the right applications for these things is part of the theological work that God has gifted me with, because God wants me to try and work out how to love one another. Sound good?